Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Our guest today is Uri Sachar of the Israel Defense and Security Forum. You might tell from his name that he is Israeli. In keeping with our general principle to get professional information from professionals and expert opinion from experts, not the New York Times or CNN, we decided we needed a view from Israel on all of those things that we have discussed from the American point of view. So first we'll do our JPC commercial, and then we will get to our guest. The JPC was established in 1985. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our Insight articles and our magazine, In Focus Quarterly. The fall issue of In Focus is up now. It is entitled Identity, Borders, and Conflict. You can guess where we're going. And do check out our In Context column on the website. We've been running timely and interesting views from people not normally seen in the American media. Excuse me. Again, it's on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And we support the government of Israel in its determination to secure its borders and its people from the malign forces around it, and to secure the release of the remaining deceased hostages and to marginalize, if not eliminate, excuse me, the military power of Hamas. It is our view that despite the gratitude for the return of the hostages, living hostages, the war is not over. Domestically, the JPC believes in small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. Again, my apologies. And now our guest. Uri Sachar is Vice President of Research and Content at the Israel Defense and Security Forum, also known by that Hebrew name that I cannot pronounce, Habitronistim, where he leads the research department and oversees the organization's media, publications, and major public events. A specialist in Israeli national security and Middle East affairs, he regularly briefs senior Israeli decision makers and has authored papers at the request of Israel's defense and intelligence agencies. He served in Unit 8200, and he holds degrees from Tel Aviv University in music. We have to ask him about that, but also Sciences Po in Paris, in international security. He previously worked at think tanks, including INSS and Austria's AIES, or has published extensively on Israeli and national security, including strategic assessments, Iran's nuclear and proxy activities, the Palestinian arena, where we're going to get there today, U.S. defense policy, and European geopolitical trends. His work appears in a variety of Israeli and international media outlets, and he hosts the ISDF's Security Talk podcast. Interestingly, Orr speaks five languages: English, Hebrew, French, Persian, and Arabic. We are going to stick to English. Uri Sachar, the floor will be yours, but I'm going to ask you to start with a question. How does Israel, both the government and the people, how does Israel view and respond to the visit of U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance to Jerusalem? Where are we?
So, hi to you, Shoshana. Hello from Israel. Shalom. It's my honor to be again with the Jewish Policy Center. I had the distinct honor of speaking to a Jewish Policy Center forum back in April, and now meeting you guys again. So it's again a great privilege, and with you, Shoshana, personally, especially. So thank you so much for having me. And yeah, we're going to talk about the war more broadly, but let's start really with the visit of the Vice President J.D. Vance. Most Israelis felt it really by, you know, all these traffic limitations with the convoy of the vice president crossing the main road from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv and vice versa. But I think that there is there's a great deal of unclarity as to what the vice president was doing here and what the main purposes of the visits were. As I view it, J.D. Vance, I think, reaffirmed his understanding of what's going on in Israel politically and with regard to the military intentions in Gaza. I think that the vice president saw a great opportunity to follow up on President Trump's visit from a couple of weeks ago, and to really have an up close observation of what Israel is doing and what it's planning next. We all know from even from our personal lives that having Zoom calls and phone calls and even hosting Prime Minister Netanyahu several times and Minister Ron Dermer, who was pivotal for this all of this affair, is not the same as visiting. And the vice president had the chance to visit the Kiryat, the military headquarters of the IDF. He met the Minister of Security. That's what in Israel we call the Minister of Defense, Israel Katz. He met the IDF Chief of Staff Eyal Zamir and Lieutenant General, and the really high echelon of the General Staff of the IDF. And he affirmed his position that Hamas must be disarmed in any future scenario. And he also said, meeting Prime Minister Netanyahu, that Israel has the full back of the United States to continue per the ceasefire agreement. There was a little bit of a scandal here when the opposition filed this bill on enacting sovereignty over Judea and Samaria. This was sort of a political trick. Vance said, "Well, I was offended, and it was a stupid vote," his words. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, affirmed that no such proposals will be moved forward. Not because theoretically we don't, of course, we view Judea and Samaria in Israel as an inherent part of the Israeli heritage and one of the main raison d'être of Israel, but because the political timing is not wise. And the big question is what to do with the territories is not something that's going to be resolved during the visit of Vice President Vance. And I think he was probably exposed a bit like President Trump during his speech in the Knesset when two MKs from the Arab party sort of waved protest signs. He was exposed also to the, the labyrinth of Israeli politics and how it's a bit of a mess here. But all in all, I think for those of us who were a bit worried about the isolationist inclinations of Vice President Vance, I think it was a bit of a sigh of relief that we have a strong alliance with the United States, no matter what who the personality in charge is.
So that makes us feel a little bit better because we haven't really had a whole lot of reporting on the visit in general. So thank you for a kind of news report as well as a assessment. So let's move on to Israeli society and talk about Israelis. So I would say from the American point of view, the Israeli society showed remarkable resilience since October 7th, 2023, but you got issues. The prime minister appears to be resisting a commission of inquiry. The economy and society are under strain from both from mobilization and from some Europeans. There are issues of warfare and the losses of warfare. And you've got elections coming up in a year. If they don't come up sooner, you've got elections coming. So, a couple of questions that go with that. How is Israeli resilience holding up? And how do you know? What's the evidence? Do you think there will be a commission of inquiry? If there is one, do you think you can do that in the course of an election year?
Right, so let's start with the état d'esprit in Israel, right? How where things stand and what is the ambience in Israel? How do Israelis in general view the war? And of course, you hear it from the horse's mouth, right? As an Israeli, but here it is viewer warning, I could say that I'm speaking for myself as I view it. You may hear a different answer from a different from another Israeli, but in my view, and I see a great deal of evidence for that, there is a great deal of resilience among Israelis, especially since the ceasefire was declared. I think the major focal point that really, I would say, managed to fracture, fragment the society was the hostages and the fact that the hostages are not released. And there became all these speculations on whether or not Prime Minister Netanyahu is interested in liberating the hostages or the common sort of, and I heard it from, senators in the Democratic Party as well, who were very critical of Netanyahu. And that is okay. But the main argument was that he is intentionally keeping the hostages in captivity. Because he, so long as they are there, he can cling on to power. I know how hard Israel and the military, the intelligence, the Mossad, the Shin Bet have been working on getting these hostages out, the elite units of the IDF. In 1 month, in June of 2025, last June, 25 soldiers were killed in action. That is more than the number of living hostages in Gaza. So definitely there is a great deal of commitment to the fate of the hostages. I think the main thing that keeps the Israeli society united is the resilience of the military and the reserves, and the fact that since David Ben-Gurion, the Israel has been a fighting society, as they say, the civil soldier model. We have our own researcher, Colonel Ronen Itzik, has even had a PhD on this topic about how Israel is really a civil soldier society, and how everyone is basically either a reservist or a family member of a reservist, or is in any way, shape, or form related to military service or police, for that matter. We saw, by the way, the elite units of the police who also participate in some of those daring actions, and so all those rapid response units. And I think in those cases, you ask yourself a main question: where is the politician versus the policy? So, for example, in the United States, it's really a 90-10 issue, right? I think around 87% of Americans say, for example, that all illegal immigrants who committed a crime should be deported. That's just, polls show it, one poll after another. A similar rate of Americans are not interested that biological males use the private spaces or the bathrooms or the locker rooms of girls. So this is just what polls show you. But when you talk about the popularity of President Trump, whether by his you can say it's for him or against him, and of course anyone espouses their own political views, but he enjoys somewhere between 40 and 50% of popularity rate, right? And of course not 87% of Americans voted for him, but these positions he happens to hold as well. And so the question is, where is the gap? Where are all the 50% of Americans who don't like President Trump, for that matter, but are in favor of his policy? What I'm getting at is that, yes, in bad days, Prime Minister Netanyahu would not have been reelected had elections been held today. And of course, I know many Israelis who are not particularly favorable of him personally or his views. But then when you ask him about policy, are you interested in a clear result in Gaza? Absolutely. Are you against the two-state solution? Absolutely. What do you think, Hamas should be eradicated? Absolutely. So these are positions that Prime Minister Netanyahu happened to hold. So my point is that the Israeli society, and it's everywhere, is resilient and is quite, I would say, 80-20 on these issues. I would also say that on the Israeli perspective, we can feel the shifting public opinion. And one of the main officers told me relatively early on in the war that our great hope is those IDF reservists who serve in Gaza 400, 500 plus days already. And what he told me back then is that those would sort of spill over to society and sort of inject this vaccine of Zionism over to society, and sort of inject those energy. Because if you listen to Security Talk in Hebrew, I should probably have a English podcast as well, but I interviewed one after another of those reservists, and they said what reunited us in the tank is that we all hold different political perspectives, but in the tank we're all together, we're all united. And I don't have to look back. I know that my pal here is with me, whether he votes for the same party as I do or not. And I think this sort of this the Israeli public, I suspect, is a bit traumatized now by October 7 and the ensuing multi-front war, but is also, I think, invigorated. And we see the motivation. We ourselves in David Institute, we had this research among young Israelis, 17, 18 years old, and the motivation to join combat roles in the IDF when they recruit at the age of 18. The motivation to recruit really is through the roof. It's through the roof. And so, and we can prove it with those research groups by Colonel Itzik and his. You can check it out in davidinstitute.org. All the data is there. And I can see that in my everyday. I do see also, however, all those signs of question marks. What is going on in Gaza right now? What's next for Gaza? And I think the main concern for Israelis right now is that most Israelis, as I said, want a clear result in Gaza. And so far, we had sort of a patchwork, right? A patchwork of a seven day long operation, 3 days of like exchange of like a rising tensions. And the main question is that, okay, we invested 2 years of blood and treasure. We invested well over 100 million shekels. That's, let's say, around $30 billion, even more. You have to remember all the people who got evacuated from the north and the south of Israel. 80,000 people were displaced in their own country. All these hotel rooms, and so all of these are expenses. And of course, all the ammunition brought from the United States and days of reserve service and all these armaments, all this costs money. But even more importantly, the some 2,000 people that were killed or murdered ever since October 7, including some 600 soldiers who were killed in Gaza, killed in action. And so that may sound not so much in terms of the war in Iraq or the war in Ukraine, but for Israelis, you know, there everyone is a story. And every me personally, even I can even identify the pictures of those soldiers, because they all became sort of a national asset in the national heritage. And there's even research about it, how national memory shapes your view, your national experience. 80 years after the Holocaust, and Holocaust survivors still keep, you know, some basic ingredients in their cupboard just in case, not to remain hungry. So what I suspect is that now we will begin a process of healing, but I wouldn't rush to declare that the war is over, and we'll just have to deal with what's coming next.
So it's interesting. First, let me point out to our listeners, the United States is about 40 times the size of Israel. So when you look at things like 1,200 people being killed on October 7th, you need to have a sense of what that means here. It is well over, it's like 48,000 people. In 9/11, we lost just under 3,000 people. So it's really important to keep in mind the differential. Size differential. So let me ask a question then, as on the hostages. Clearly, everyone in Israel was just unbelievably happy and rightfully unbelievably happy. Raises two questions. First, in Israel, the line was bring them home now. On the hostage tags, it was bring them home now. The demonstrations were all called bring them home now. The implication of bring them home is that it's the government's obligation to bring them home. It wasn't clear to me how the government was supposed to bring them home, whether it's a deal or it's a war or whatever, but bring them home lays the burden on the government. If you demand release them now, you put the burden on Hamas. So the question is, did framing it that way, framing it as an obligation of the Israeli government to bring them home rather than an obligation on Hamas to release them or send them home, did that encourage Hamas? You know, we talk about Israeli motivation. We talk about, the positive motivations of the people of Israel. What about Hamas?
You know, one of the things that saddened me the most is to see how even the hostage issue has become politicized. And, you know, I have to tell you, we used to have this the hostage lapel pin here. Of course, there are still about 12 hostage bodies in Gaza. Sometimes when people saw me wearing that lapel pin, they ask me, "Oh, so you're part of the demonstrations and all that. Isn't that the leftist lapel pin now?" And that makes me very sad, because I remember myself in 2023, before the October 7 massacre. I saw there was a height of the protest movement in Israel against the judicial reform. You all remember that. And I saw a car in my Jerusalem neighborhood with an Israel flag on it. And it's very common in Israel to have Israel flags, the national flag, in your car. I asked myself, "Oh, they're part of the protest movement." And then I sort of had the moment when I said, "Oh, actually, it's just the Israeli flag." My point is that sometimes we tend to attribute, you know, all these, you know, commonly held assets that are national assets, that are of all of us, the hostages, the national flag, and so on. But they're sort of hijacked in the name of a political slogan. And I'm so saddened to see that some of those protests focused on accusation rather than national unity. And for that reason, I didn't really feel at home going to those protests, even though I, rhetorically at least, fought for the release of the hostages in the TV panels and with the decision makers and all these policy papers that we filed. So you hear it even from released hostages. So to one of the released hostages said, they were doing some psychological terrorism on them while they were, you know, locked in tunnels in Gaza. Some of them spent 2 years in a cage around the size of their body, receiving half a pita bread per day, returning half their weight. I I salute them. First of all, they are my heroes. You know, I don't know how you survived 2 years like this. Some of them were completely alone, but they said, like, they showed them Al Jazeera of all TV networks, and they said, "You see all these protests? You don't see your sign there, right? They forgot about you." Or, I remember seeing those hostage videos back then when they were in captivity, and they said, "Please go out to the streets, protest, make a scene, make your voices heard." They made the hostages say that they read their script. And of course, people dutifully went out to the street. But my point is that Hamas is exceptional with the psychological terrorism, and we can talk about that. But the kind of, for example, on social media, the way they send out influencers with 16 million viewers to document everything in Gaza and TikTok and Instagram, and they're incredibly successful. One of them had a video of him rescuing two toddlers, you know, with bloodstains all over the body, and I can see as someone who deals with these things every day, it was completely fabricated, but it got 100 million views. You see, and before being released, those hostages were calling their families, you know, like this, like holding up their phones and calling their families in video calls, Shoshana, while they were still in Gaza. And you see a Hamas militant standing behind them, you know, and they said, "I'm okay, I'm about to be released." As Adin al-Qassam, the Hamas military wing, was very grateful for graciously agreeing to release me and so on. Why do this, right? You don't have to do this if you want to win the battlefield, because they understand that the war of information is no less important, even more important than the war on the battlefield. And Hamas understood that very well. Russia and China understand it very well. That's why they throw billions at American universities and protest movements to stoke instability in the West. And so I am coming back to the difference between the politician and the policy. I think Israelis are united around that cause. But again, it's just when you hear, for example, I don't know if all of you know the names, but Tzvika Mohr, for example, he's the father of one of the released hostages, and he established his own forum of hostage families. And you had the main hostage HQ, which was considered the center left. His forum is considered center right, and their claim was, "Don't not bring them home, but rather set them free, right? The pressure should be on Hamas." And he said, "I'm so saddened that if 1/10 of that money and effort would go on pressuring Hamas and protesting in front of the UN and calling on Iran and Qatar to put pressure on Hamas to release the hostages, I think we would have seen them sooner." And I have a reason to believe that some of these even pushed the date of the release of the hostages further away because Hamas's price just got up. And it of course families can protest, of course, and they need to make their voices heard. But I have a good reason to believe that much of the movement around it was also dedicated to sort of political outrage or things that sort of took the issue of the hostages and used it as an expedient political tool. And it just saddens me because it should not be this way.
So I don't want to get sidetracked, but I'm going to sidetrack for a second. There are certain things that increase Hamas's status everywhere. One of those, I assume, is the French declaration supported by the British and the Canadians and the Spanish and the Australians, not that anybody really cares what Australians think, never mind, that they would recognize a Palestinian state. And they did that exactly at the moment that President Trump and the Israeli government were united in a way to pressure Hamas. How much influence do you think the Europeans had on Hamas's decision to stop the conversation at that point? And then I'm going to ask you another question about Europeans.
In my view, it completely would win the sales of Hamas. I think in that sense, it's quite transparent that there is a direct correspondent linkage or a ratio between the level of domestic pressure and illegal immigration and the domestic instability in those countries and their venom and hostility toward Israel. And their commitment to the Palestinian cause is the same commitment that they don't show toward even much more disturbing conflicts around the world. I haven't seen much of an outrage on the 400,000 Yemenites who died in hunger in the past few years. And I haven't seen the level of outrage at millions who perished in Rwanda or we could talk about a million other conflict flashpoints. But Europe, in my view, is traumatized by World War II. They can see how border disputes trigger major wars and can quickly get spin out of control. And so their main concern is that the friction between Israelis and Palestinians could trigger a wider Middle Eastern war, and it will spill over to Europe, and it would cause migration waves. And then that would trigger some people like President Macron to at first be very friendly toward Israel and sort of say, okay, I understand there's been a he visited Israel and then Cairo right after October 7, and he said, you know, we have your back. And then he said, we view the solution, the ultimate solution to this conflict is two-state solution. And it's not shockingly new. So that is an okay political view to take, even in those days. But then you start with there are way too many civilians who died in Gaza. How do you know that? Well, the United Nations say so in the daily reports. What is the source in those daily reports? The Gaza Ministry of Health, ergo Hamas. So you got a fake outrage all around the world because of Hamas reporting, sort of whitewashed as United Nations objective reports. And then, of course, you have the accusations on hospitals and schools and all of the fake news. And Hamas are experts at it. As I said, they're experts in engineering our point of view to a specific viewpoint and creating sub-narratives and propagating them online. And the Russians and the Chinese have a great deal of interest to wreak havoc and instability in the West. And so they sort of they stoke the flames, really, in that sense of disinformation toward Israel because but these politicians in the West, in Western Europe mostly, just saw it as an expedient political experiment, you know, to be tough toward Israel and muscle up toward Israel because they want to appease, I suspect, and that's what President Trump and Vice President Vance say. They want to appease their domestic I would say voting groups. Secretary Rubio said it amazingly well when he said they you don't establish countries in press conferences. You do it in the dialogues between the parties. And so I believe it was harmful to the release of the hostages. I think it had wins in Hamas' sales. I think Hamas had no motivation to release the hostages faster because there was a wave of recognition of Palestine around the world. And I would tell you that was a bit amazing to see how on Wednesday, Thursday, you had the impression that the international community is united behind the idea of recognizing Palestine as the ultimate solution to the conflict. And 150 countries vote in the United Nations to recognize Palestine, led by France and Saudi Arabia. But that is the prescription. It is not the real policy. And you got a couple of days later, you got Netanyahu and Trump over at the White House declaring that actually a document was signed by over 20 Arab and Muslim countries embracing the Israeli-American plan for Gaza and say, hey, which is it? So in my view, there are underlying currents in the Middle East that Western Europe is blind to, and they don't really distinguish ideology and interests. They don't really read the subtext of declarations in the Arab world when they are very aggressive. We will never normalize with Israel until the two-state solution is put together and all that. This is really the rhetoric behind, and behind it, there is a real fear from Iran, which I suspect we'll talk about more, and China and all that. And they just want the West's involvement in the Middle East. And Europe fails to understand that. And I'll finish up with that, I am optimistic about, for example, David Lammy, the UK foreign minister, who said there is no genocide in Gaza. Germany said there is no genocide in Gaza. Italy, no genocide in Gaza. Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff in their 60 Minutes interview, absolutely not. We haven't seen genocide. We saw war, and wars are dirty and ugly, and things happen in wars. So at least in that respect, it's encouraging.
Okay, so, but that goes to another point, which is that Hamas and its friends, including, I think people don't understand the role of China and Russia and Iran in the bots and the social media. I mean, you need to understand that these guys are spending millions, if not more than that, creating the bots, creating the social media. Now, one of the things that happened in Europe before Lemmy said there was no genocide and before Maloney said there was no genocide is that a lot of those countries, not Germany and not Italy, interestingly, we're cutting ties with Israel in various ways. We're not going to take their military equipment. We're not going to have, you know, the Britain says you can't bring your soccer players here, whatever. And if you put on top of that the social media inclination, European publics, and I'm not talking about the immigrants from the Middle East, but European publics begin to see Israel as the bad guy. Now, If we're all lucky, cooler heads will now prevail, and the understanding that there was no genocide and the understanding that there was no famine will come to people's minds. Can you repair the relations, however, between Israel and the Israeli public and Europe and the European public? Can you fix that? I see that Germany said that if Israel is out of Eurovision, Germany will be out of Eurovision. And Austria, which is the host of Eurovision, says if Israel is out of Eurovision, we're not hosting. So is it possible that that will help influence the populations of those countries to rethink?
Absolutely. And yeah, absolutely. And I think it merely attests the diversity of opinion within Europe as it relates to Israel. And as someone who visits Europe quite often, I can tell you that there are many viewpoints in Europe, especially in the center right, but also on the left sometimes, that are really supportive of what Israel is doing. More so, they are frustrated by the level of, like, the sort of their own governments right now are in putting the relationship with Israel under in jeopardy. And for them, the relationship with Israel is much more important than ideological, sort of political grandstanding as it relates to the Gaza conflict, because they care about Israeli technology, and Israel just sold a $3 billion contract of Arrow 3 to Germany against Russian missiles. And you had
Wait, wait,
major.
wait. You understand that those were the missiles that Spain canceled. Germany said, when Spain canceled its military relationship with Israel, Germany said, you know those missiles? We'll take them. So not
Absolutely.
only did Germany stand up, but Spain now looks around and says, wait a minute, what did we gain by doing that? We gained nothing. And,
And there is a
you know.
great deal of domestic political backlash against as Pedro Sanchez in Spain. Many in Spain view him as too aggressive toward Israel, even when Friedrich Merz of Germany was more aggressive toward Israel in his rhetoric. There was a great deal of criticism within his own party toward that, and he indeed sort of try to mend those relationships ever since. He issued really a number of sort of appeasing statements. And I do see in Europe, especially on the right, but not only, encouraging signs that they understand that Israel is an asset. It's not a liability. They don't, sometimes, and we're in the Jewish Policy Center, so I can tell you that
Yeah.
as a Jewish person myself, speaking sometimes in like in Europe, and I can sometimes I've had enough of behaving as if I'm still in the galut, and sometimes it's easier to get Jewish people, our own kin, out of diaspora, out of the galut, than getting the galut out of us, meaning that we are still thinking as if we're still there in the medieval ages, and we don't realize, as the state of Israel at least, the state of Israel has not realized yet the level of the asset that it represents for those countries. We are not a third-tier country anymore. Germany, Spain, Italy, all these countries' defense industry is far, Israel's one is far superior to theirs. And the level of contracts, cyber, AI, missile defense systems. I'll just say it bluntly, they are not doing Israel a favor by holding these relations. They are benefiting greatly from it. So I think it's kind of shooting yourself in the leg when you cancel contracts that would protect your homeland just for political reasons or ideological reasons. But it was sort of grandstanding, and I suspect that right now the smoke clears. I suspect that what President Trump said it the best in his interview to Fox News, right, the phone interview, right when the ceasefire was signed. He said, "It's time to love Israel again." And I think that more people around the world will feel it right now.
So you raised another interesting point. So Israel operates in CENTCOM with American forces in the US Central Command, but it hasn't really given up its relations with EUCOM, the European Command, where it had operated for so many years. What do you see as the relationship between European fighting forces and the IDF? Has the rela and I know that they had a close relationship. Has the war weakened the relations? Are militaries less susceptible to political propaganda? How's Israel doing with the militaries in Europe?
In my view, and as I and I'm from many meetings that I had with those relevant people to those military cooperation centers, the relationship between the professional and military echelons could not have been better. I meet professional military and defense people in Europe. They are thrilled by having ties with Israel that supplies them with intelligence and defense technologies and all these things. Usually, and that is very typical, even for politicians who came out of the military, they are much more likely to be supportive of Israel than their fellow diplomats who came from diplomatic corps. I think we all know how it feels like. And so, but again, I have to we have to remember that when we talk about Europe in general, and sometimes Israelis, have mix up between Europe in general and the different currents within Europe. And I can tell you, as someone who knows the scene in Central Europe very well, for example, Hungary, Slovakia, Poland, these countries are extreme, Czech Republic, of course, they are extremely supportive of Israel. Hungary is the one country who sent a representative to the signing ceremony of the Abraham Accords. The European Union boycotted it altogether. They said, well, that's not the way to have a direct relationship between Israel and Morocco or Bahrain or the UAE before putting that whole two-state solution thing to rest. And this is really not the method, in my view. And I think Jared Kushner said it the best. He said, it's time to listen rather than lecture. Hey, we're in the Middle East. It's not our country anymore. We're not a co it's not colonialist times anymore. We're here to listen to the peoples of the region. What matters to the Bahrainis? What matters to the Emiratis? What matters to the Saudis? What matters to the Israelis? Let's listen to them. And I think the European Union, especially the sort of diplomatic milieu over in Brussels, felt that they have one prescription and they stick to it. But there are many undercurrents in Western Europe. We can see how East Europe and Central Europe are mostly favorable to Israel. When there was a move to push sanctions against Israel in the European Commission, a whole host, I believe some 17 member states who opposed that, Germany, Austria, Italy, many important states in Europe. And so there are encouraging signs that there is a reckoning in Europe that Israel is an asset for them. And the only hindrance that could be and is, of course, in my view, mass migration, illegal, irregular migration. France and the UK host some 500,000 new immigrants yearly each. One in every 25 people who live in the UK has arrived in the last 4 years. It's untenable. It's untenable. And I felt it when I lived in Paris, and now it's even more severe. So I think this is the major obstacle facing these countries. It's kind of civilizational, cultural, geostrategic choices that they'll make in the coming years.
There's also a little bit of European colonialism left. The Hungarians were not colonialists. The French and the British certainly weren't. I do suspect that they think that what they say matters in that context. And I don't think they're right. So I would rather be in a room with a lot of Arab countries plus Hungary than in a room with the British and the French trying to work this out. So I think President Trump was
Suspect
quite
the
right
food would
about
be
that.
better too.
And totally. Okay, so there's one more group of people, and then I'm going to ask you about what's actually sort of happening in Gaza. So you talked about Europeans and Israelis and Americans. Let's talk about Palestinians for a minute. So Israel released 250 murderers. I mean, come on, and another 1,700 other people who did other things, all of which were bad things. Does that enable Hamas to present itself? I know they'll try. As a heroic light and the savior of those people and guarantee future terrorism? Or are the Palestinian people in Gaza really tired of Hamas and this is not what the release of those people is not the first thing on their minds. The first thing on their minds perhaps is getting rid of Hamas. So where are the Palestinian people in this? Gaza
Well,
people specifically.
so there are a number of ways to tell. One of them is public polls, opinion polls, and the only credible ones that are being conducted were those by the PSR. There is a sort of a polling company run by this guy called Khalil Shkaki, and he runs these quarterly polls. Yes, in the level of support in Hamas in Gaza has declined ever since October 7. They were perceived as national heroes, even in Gaza. They now enjoy more popularity in Judea and Samaria than in Gaza. That's according to his polls. And yes, there was a steep decline in support of Hamas. 85% of Palestinians supported the October 7 massacre, shockingly. Hamas's popularity could not be higher in Gaza following the October 7 attacks. They were perceived as some people like to call it here, the modern day Salah ad-Din, right? The great Yahya Sinwar would be the great conqueror who would liberate Palestine and so on and so forth. It's very hard to tell because, as we said before, we sort of tend to be smug maybe toward the peoples of the Middle East. The Palestinians are no fool, and they know. And they know that politicians take them to their advantage. And they had enough, especially when you see all these TikTok videos of Palestinians protesting against Hamas, the El Shabaab and other militia groups who have shootouts, active gunfights with Hamas militants. I suspect that that's why you see all these mass public executions in Gaza by Hamas people. And I would suspect that much of that causes anger and frustration among Palestinians in Gaza. I would note the sad irony that the international community seems to be very concerned about Palestinian civilians dying in Gaza only when Israel accidentally kills them, as opposed to Hamas militants purposefully execute them in the public square. So I think it's just sad to see how the fake outrage is only there when Israel acts in self-defense, issues evacuation warnings and eviction warnings, and supplies 1 million tons of humanitarian aid ever since October 7th. So that's the sort of in brackets, in parenthesis, the sort of international angle of it. But as it relates to the Palestinians, if Hamas ran today in the Gaza Strip, it would win, in my view, absolutely. And the polls show it, and social media shows it. We had a research a month before October 7 among Palestinians on social media, and there is no comparison. Hamas outpolls Fatah of the Palestinian Authority in every parameter, whether it be the number of Telegram groups or followers or views to their videos or even students elected for the local universities, to the student associations. So, but nowadays in this day and age in Gaza, yes, of course there is a great deal of frustration toward Hamas in Gaza, but still. The cause is different. I think it would be very hard to find Palestinians in Gaza who are not in favor of Hamas's political perspective, as in the armed struggle is number one. Israel is the big occupier. We are committed to fighting Zionism, and the support of October 7 is high. But then when you ask them if the Hamas is the best representative of this viewpoint, their opinions split. But I. After 2 decades of really brainwashing, USSR style, well, everyone under the age of 20 right now in Gaza have received par excellence Hamas education. And you see toddlers, 3, 4 years old, with Hamas, bandage, the green bandage that they wear on their heads. And they go to summer camps, and they shoot at all those fake dolls of Israeli soldiers. So what can possibly be the result 20 years later? You have a public in Gaza that may be frustrated at the way Hamas governs or led them to this catastrophe, but is also very much committed to countering Israel. And that is the sad reality of it.
So I imagine, though, that some of that also has to do with the fact that they don't have a lot of choices. If you look at the Israeli political spectrum, you can go from the very far right all the way up through the center and out to the left, and you can get to the very far left. If you're a Palestinian, you basically have a choice between Hamas, Fatah, and being a traitor by saying you'd rather work with Israel and see if you could, make a better life for yourself. So part of it is going to have to do with something that we did, and short story. So you know that after World War II, we occupied Germany, we occupied Japan, we wrote their constitutions, we tried their criminals, we executed some people, we wrote their textbooks, we did all the sorts of things that create new societies and make the old ideology, doesn't make it go away, but it makes it impolite to be that in society. It was impolite to be a Nazi in Germany at a certain point. Anyway, I mentioned this to an Egyptian who was talking about elections and things for the Palestinians without acknowledging what you just said, which is that people were raised in the ideology and you have to do something about it. And he said, oh, no, we can't do that. So I don't know where you go if you can't deal with the ideology. Now, what you can do, and here's a question for you from somebody who's listening. You can try to militarily defeat them and then ensure that they don't get to have any power. But I think we're past that. You know, who's going to disarm Hamas? And that's a question for you. A lot of people have said Hamas will not govern Gaza, and they still say Hamas has to be disarmed, but they don't tell you who's going to do it. So who's going to disarm Hamas? And who's going to
Well,
alter the structure?
first of all, the very idea of disarming Hamas was disparaged by, professional politicians and opinion leaders. I remember President Macron saying, on the cameras, not, in closed doors, saying, well, the idea of destroying Hamas is impossible because you can't destroy an ideology. And they all sort of repeat the same echo chamber talking points. I have to say, ideologies can be won over. I'm not just talking about Nazi Germany, where there are still Nazis in Germany, but not
There are.
people who espouse the Nazi ideology in Germany, but they are not in power and they are a marginal minority in Germany. Japan has transitioned from being, a pretty fanatical kind of public that would attack Pearl Harbor and go after the United States in World War II to this very modern democracy. You can combat ideology in different ways. I know that same-sex marriage was illegal in almost the entire international community all around the world up until two decades ago. That's it. 2 decades ago, it was illegitimate to do it. In the 1950s, 96% of Americans opposed interracial marriage between, for example, a black man and a white woman. 96% opposed it. Now, 4% oppose it. The direct mirror image. So, indeed, ideologies can be won over. And I don't buy into the fact that, you have to give up and let Hamas prosper because that's our fate. I don't accept that. It's not Israel's fate to keep bleeding in the borders of Gaza. And Hamas should be disarmed first for the Palestinians themselves, not to lead them toward this very grim future, but also for the peace of the Middle East, because before October 7, things in the Middle East were fairly stable. But this one opened, the doors of hell, as they say it, to a multi-front war. It was much larger than Gaza. Israel was attacked by Iran itself with long-range missiles, by its proxies in Lebanon's Hezbollah, of course, Gaza, the Houthis in Yemen, militias in Syria, in Iraq, Judea and Samaria, the Arab population there, and so, and of course, the dimension of the war of information, delegitimization, the United Nations protest movements, and all that. So that triggered a much bigger mess than just the borders of Gaza, and thereby, if you have to administer the right remedy, they would go far beyond the borders of Gaza as well. That's what President Trump keeps saying, that it's much larger than Gaza. And he is playing chess right now to make sure that somehow his vision of expanding the Abraham Accords comes true now that the Gaza issue is allegedly put to rest. And that's very important to the administration, for Israel as well. Netanyahu knows how much the issue of peace in the Middle East is important to Trump. And as opposed to, let's say, the Clinton-Rabin years in the 1990s, you do it out of a position of strength and not of a position of Israel gives up land in order to create peace and sort of outsources the PLO and the Yasser Arafat on the heads of the Palestinians, most of whom opposed Arafat. Most of the Palestinians didn't have the first idea. Why would you bring some foreigner who spent most of his life abroad to govern us? So I think that is primarily the reason why Trump sees this way. And let's see what happens in Gaza. But again, the idea that Hamas cannot be disarmed is fiction. Israel proved that it can disarm Hamas. Much of his capabilities were taken away from it. It's senior leadership. The cadre of the brothers Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh was taken down in Tanwar, and Saleh Al-Arouri was taken down in the heart of Beirut, in the Hezbollah stronghold. And it is possible. The only question is, what do you do in the day after? As Netanyahu said in Congress, My vision for Gaza is a demilitarized and de-radicalized Gaza. And when I met senior officials from the Netanyahu administration, they repeated the same thing. We will not have a Gaza that is not de-radicalized. The textbooks, and if you saw all the pictures that came out of Gaza, Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography, of course, translated into Arabic, is dominant in the Gaza curriculum. The Hamas textbooks, this cannot continue. And if you want to create a future in the Middle East that is tolerable, for people who live here.
Wait, you said something important there. Not that you didn't say other important things, but you just said the textbooks and you have to de-radicalize and all. UNRWA reopened its schools this week, and UNRWA is using its textbooks. They are not modified by anybody. So, again, it raises the question, who's going to do what? Now, here's the real question. I can't think of a president, an American president, who would have been as patient with Israel and allowing Israel to determine the parameters of the war and allowing Israel to decide what's necessary as President Trump. So that's the plus news. And I know that in Israel he is very highly thought of. Question I have, do people in Israel worry that Trump wants to win so badly that he will be willing to overlook certain things in order to get the win? So that's the first question. The second question that goes with that is if, in fact, he takes the win and the win isn't real because the win has not demilitarized Hamas, the textbooks, and all that sort of stuff, is the Israeli government able to return to a war footing in Gaza without American support?
The answer to the first question is yes. The second question is no. That is to say that Israelis are worried that Trump would sort of skip and sort of, we call it cut corners, right, in order to
Cut corners.
reach a deal. And needless to say, Israel cannot continue to a war footing in Gaza without American support. Losing American support is out of the question for Israel. The US-Israel alliance is strategic. It's not like a nice to have. It's strategic and central to Israel's defense doctrine. But I do think that by and large, there are many concerns out in the media and reports on X and everywhere on Trump sort of pressuring Netanyahu to agree to a bad deal. Trump would go. I remember before the 12-day war in June between Israel and Iran, there were multiple reports on Trump sort of putting it as a using it as a negotiation tactic, and he actually intends on going back to the JCPOA and sign a bad deal with Iran. And I published this article that basically on Jerusalem Post, who basically said, it is a bizarre thing that the Iranians think that Trump would go agree to a bad deal with them, and sort of this try to sweet talk the Trump administration by sort of alluring to there. Okay, let's. I remember the Iranian foreign minister say, how about you build 19 nuclear reactors in Iran? It would be American investment and all that. Trump doesn't buy these things. I mean, what he cares, as I see it, I may be wrong, but as I see it, Trump sees America first as, but not America alone. And he understands the value in his partners and alliances around the world. He wouldn't risk the US interests on the way. If you ask me about American boots on the ground in Gaza, the chances, in my view, are not close to zero. They are zero. I don't see American troops.
Good.
I mean, I just don't see it happen, and I don't think Israelis view it as necessary. Netanyahu said in his speech to Congress, "We don't need U.S. boots on the ground. We defend ourselves." And we have a whole article coming up on it on the David Institute website. Basically, says Israel never sought U.S. boots on the ground, but the U.S. support is something else. It's not just supplying arms and the $14 billion that are passing Congress. It is also giving an American umbrella to the expansion of the Abraham Accords. What I mentioned before, the dividends of the peace are going to be the expansion of the Abraham Accords and peace between Israel and Arab countries. Trump said in the Knesset just a couple of weeks ago that Israel, with our help, has won all that they can by force of arms. You've won. Now it's time to translate these victories against terrorists on the battlefield into the ultimate prize of peace and prosperity for the entire Middle East, basically the fruits of our labor. He speaks about the Middle East in general. God bless the Middle East, right? So we may sort of divert into Trump now, but as I view it, America is an inherently optimistic place. And Americans, as I see it, represented especially by this administration, I think, looks for solutions, not history lessons. This, by the way, was the main mistake, I think, of President Zelensky when he first came to the White House and started, going back to 1560 or whenever that was, and starting to lecture Trump about how the Minsk agreement was a failure and catastrophe and all that. And he may be right in all of that, but it doesn't matter. And Israelis do the same. They start with history lessons, and in Oslo, the Palestinians refused, and two different Israeli prime ministers offered them 96% of the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, and they refused. And Bill Clinton attests to that the Arafat and Abu Mazen and Mahmoud Abbas were stubborn and did not agree to end the conflict. All that is true, but for Trump, it doesn't matter. What matters is, as Mike Huckabee put it once, one, can it work? Two, will it make the situation better? If the answer to two of these questions is yes, then great, I'm all for it. And then when they asked President Trump, are you for the two-state solution? He said, I'm ambivalent. I mean, he probably didn't say ambivalent, but he said, I don't care. I mean, either two-state, one state, 10 states, I don't care. So long as the two parties are happy, I'm happy. And it is an inherently optimistic vision. I remember him, even elsewhere, he gives a press briefing in the Rose Garden. And he says, oh, you hear the sound of construction, the new ballroom that everybody talks about now in the East Wing of the White House. And he says, oh, that's music to my ears because construction means money. It's inherently optimistic. I want to build things. I want to create new things. He sees Gaza as a beach front, property, right?
Potential, yes.
Potential, right? We all wait for Gaza Lago, right? The new Trump Hotel in Gaza. But he really does see the Middle East this way. He came to Riyadh and gave the most optimistic speech I ever heard in my life. He said, I want you to build things. I want you to come together. You are tired of wars. And he's absolutely right. The question is, what prescription would work in Gaza? Because just saying to Israel, you won, get out, let's put it to rest and let's throw money at the problem in Gaza. That is our danger, to sort of, be smell the sort of the steam of euphoria and just forget about October 7 and the reason why it happened in the first place, how Hamas rearmed, how it used all the money that came into Gaza for its terror purposes rather than to empower the people of Gaza, how it put hundreds of millions of dollars into a tunnel system longer than the Lo London Underground and the Paris Metro in order to hold hostages and I just don't see the same logic applies to Gaza as in the West. If you throw money at the West, you thrive. If you throw money on Gaza, it just redirects itself into terrorism. So I just think that we have to be very smart to disarm Hamas as a first step, de-radicalize Gaza as a second step, and then find common sense solutions for the Palestinians who are there so that they never again pose a threat on Israel.
Okay, so we're coming to the end. I'm checking my watch here. The other thing Israel has to be aware of, though, as we close the program, is that in 3 years, the United States will have a new president and a new administration. Trump is out. So you are also time bound because it's really hard to imagine a president that does what he does. Sometimes he's successful, sometimes he is not successful. But I think you nailed it. He's a builder. He believes in prosperity. He believes in, just getting on and making good things happen. And that's great. But we're going to have somebody else, for better or for worse. I don't know yet. And I don't want to talk about it yet. But question for Jerusalem, question for the Israeli government is, what do you need to consolidate your gains in those 3 years? What do you need to ensure that you have with this president who's going to help you do it before he leaves? What are your priority goals from now until our next election, never mind your next election.
No, that's such an important question, and I'm glad you raised it. And indeed, with the Trump administration, Israel has to act fast and to move fast and to, first of all, win over the low-hanging fruits. I so say the dividends of war. Okay, Israel just fought a two-year-long war, basically eradicated most of Iran's nuclear program and ballistic missile program. Hezbollah is mostly gone, and there is a new prospect of peace with Lebanon. We never imagined such a thing. There is advanced talk openly with on a security agreement with Syria, of all places, a country that never recognized Israel. And the new president, Sharaa, openly says it. He admits that there are advanced negotiations with Israel. I think the key here is Gaza and the way sort of Israel maneuvers with the help of the international community, and the field of information. In the end, how disinformation, deliberate mass starvation, all these things that were said about Israel and sort of triggered violence against Jewish communities overseas as well, how all these things now are hopefully behind us, and we can translate the achievements of the war into peace. That is the main thing Israel should work on. Forget everything else. Work on peace agreements with the Muslim world, with the Arab world. Take Saudi Arabia, for example. A month before October 7, you had Netanyahu and MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, visiting the United Nations to the, General Assembly annual conference. And both openly admitted that they are very close to Israeli-Saudi normalization, very close to peace. And then Iran, you can say, freaked out. I don't know if it's I'm allowed to say that, but Iran took it very seriously. And Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei said, don't bet on the losing horse. And Israel will be eradicated by all these resistant groups in the region. He meant all these Iranian funded terror armies. And indeed, October 7 happened and the ensuing war. And Israel bounced back, right? And as I mentioned, the region looks different now. Changing the face of the Middle East. But now we have to formalize it. And starting perhaps with Oman, Pakistan, Indonesia, there were rumors on Indonesia welcoming 1 million Palestinians for temporary protection, and normalize relations, the largest Muslim nation in the world. It's no mean feat. Talks about normalizing relations with Syria and Lebanon. I think and the main prize, of course, Saudi Arabia, the custodian of the holy places in the Muslim world. All these things have to happen. And I think President Trump is the ideal person to do it. I think people pay a great deal of respect to him in the Middle East. He respected the Arab world by dedicating his first visit to in this term, coming to Riyadh, Qatar, and the UAE, much like his first term, I have to say. But now he comes back as a much more It's a much stronger leader, much more sober, much more understanding of the region. There is a great deal of awe, not just respect, And if you remember, a couple of years ago, Saudi Arabia signed this MOU, this agreement with Iran, with Chinese mediation to normalize relations. And now you just don't see that happen right now because Trump basically would not go along with it. So now we have such awe and respect for an American president. You have to use the time that you have, move fast, strike these peace deals, and I think this interconnectivity, energy lines, oil and gas lines, these trade routes, IMEC, all these the projects they talk about to bring goods from India through the Arab Peninsula, Israel, and onto Europe, all these things will make America safer. That would stabilize the region. It will the all of the burden sharing of the flashpoints around the world would be mitigated in the Middle East. And I think America views Israel as its main partner in the region. It's the only country that could take on Iran. Tiny Israel is dominating the skies of Iran and doing what no other country in the world, not even France, not anyone, would dare to do, to take on Iran's nuclear weapons program. All these things are respected in the Middle East. And I think America sees Israel as a strong but also sober player that can say stop, that can sort of recognize victory and use the fruits of their labor in order to translate a military achievement into a diplomatic success and strike those peace deals. And I hope with all my heart that it's going to happen.
So I like to go out on an optimistic note, and you've given us one. It will take a lot of hard work. It will take a lot of very clever planning. But I think if Israel and the United States are on the same page and working toward the same end, and there are partners in the Middle East, it could happen. So before I thank you and let you go, let me say to our viewers, we have a different program next week. We are pre-recording Jonathan Shanzer. A lot of you know John Shanzer. He is fabulous and brilliant and wonderful. And we are going to pre-record him. So instead of getting invitation to tune in Thursday at noon, we are going to send you a notice of when that program has been taped and posted on our website. So we'll be sending out the link and we'll be sending out the notice, but you are not going to get an invitation to lunch next week. Now, I would like to thank Ori Zahar for a wonderful, wonderful overview of how Israel sees the things that we see from a different angle, and also for providing a lot of information that the US press doesn't provide. I don't want to get into a conversation about the press, but what you did for us, Or, is help us look at the world from Israel's point of view and understand what's going on in the home of our closest ally in the region and one of our closest allies in the world. So thank you very much, and I hope you'll come back again.
Thank you so much, Ashana. Thank you for having me.